Unitarian Universalist minister David Rankin tells the story of how he was just finishing up a cup of coffee at his local diner when a road-weary family came in for lunch. He describes how the family's 6-year-old son was filled with the energy of the recently released. So he bounced on the booth seat, talked nonstop until the waitress arrived to take their order. She looked at the boy and said, "So what would you like for lunch?" With big eyes glancing at his mom and dad, he quickly said, "Hot dog." She responded, "Fries?" "Yes." "And what to drink?" Before she finished, he said, "Coke." "Okay," was the response, and the waitress took the parents' order and left. Sitting completely still, with the same wide eyes, the little boy said to his mother, "Mom, she thinks I'm real." How is a person made real, after all? How do we know when a person is a person? My niece Abigail was almost 4 when her baby sister Emily arrived, and for at least the first year of Emily's life, Abby would ask her mom, "Mom, when will Emily be a people?" Aren't little kids so good at zeroing in on some of life's most complex questions? In this case, my niece was pondering one component of what theologians would call theological anthropology. What makes someone a person? In David Rankin's story of the diner, the little boy experiences firsthand one of liberal theology's best answers. We are made real by way of our capacity to make our own choices. We differentiate ourselves as human beings by way of our capacity for self-determination. We freely choose, therefore we are. It was this assertion that in many ways paved the way to today's Unitarian Universalist Church. We can rightfully trace our religious roots back to the Puritans, who came en masse from England to the shores of what would become Massachusetts. I shared that piece of our religious history with you a few weeks ago in what I have come to characterize as my apologetic for the Cambridge platform. But as you might have guessed, at a certain point, our history, it parts ways with the orthodoxy of the Puritan congregational churches. Or rather, it parted ways over a number of years, but over a very particular doctrine, directly related to this question of theological anthropology. The Puritans, you might realize, were diehard Calvinists, which is to say, they believed in predestination. Which means they believe that God decided your path for you. Whether you were saved or damned, whether you were chosen or doomed, one of the elect, or to borrow a phrase from contemporary versions of this theology, one of the left behind. Whether or not you were one of the elect had nothing to do with your own choices or your own actions. Your destiny was pre-decided, preordained by God. The path of your life was set even before you were born. Now, you might wonder, what would lead human beings, I mean lots of them, to accept and affirm such a disempowering way of thinking of themselves? Now, there are lots of reasons, including social and historical factors at the time, then and now, as to why predestination seem the best possible option for thinking about the moral questions of life. Perhaps most of all, it is the necessary conclusion when you are committed, as they were, to thinking about God as what my Bible professor in seminary called as omni-omni. That is, omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, right? Omni-omnis. All-powerful, all-knowing, always, everywhere. When you have a God that knows everything, is in charge of everything, and is in everything and everywhere, well, you can't escape that God's will would define and determine all of human destiny. Every commitment you make in theology has a consequence. And in this case, you get a super powerful God, but a super weak humanity. What kind of God would you prefer? Predestination was the party line in the 17th and 18th century colonial religious scene, but as with any religious group then and now, it was never 100% accepted. There are always those who wondered, who questioned, who began to imagine other ways of thinking about our will and its freedom or lack thereof. These heretics, those are our people. And our people found their public voice toward the end of the 18th century when Charles Chauncey began to preach on the possibility, just the possibility, that humans had within them what he called a likeness to God, which had implications both in terms of the quality of our nature as well as our capacity to make choices and determine the course of our lives. Half a century later, as contemporary UU scholar Paul Razor tells it, in 1828, Unitarian minister William Ellery Channing, whose words we read earlier in the responsive reading, he preached a well-known sermon using likeness to God as his title, stating what was by then the widely held liberal view. Channing claimed that the divinity within us makes us more and more partakers of the moral perfection of the supreme being. 10 years later, Channing declared even more boldly that human beings, and this is a quote, have the power not only of tracing our powers, but of guiding and impelling them. Not only of watching our passions, but of controlling them. Not only of seeing our faculties grow, but of applying them, means and influences to aid their growth. We can, he says, fix our eyes on perfection and make almost everything speed toward it. Channing, who is known today as the founder of American Unitarianism, was saying that human beings have the power to control their feelings, their ideas, their understandings. Actually, he says, we have the power to become perfect. No matter what our life circumstances, he says, no matter what we are born into, we are capable of becoming anything. It is up to us. We like this, right? I mean, it suits us. We, the inheritors of this liberal religious vision of free will and self-determination, this gospel of self-improvement, it resonates for us. I mean, anything you want, work hard enough, it can be yours. The future is in our hands. We'll build a land where we'll bind up the broken, goes one of our songs. Our liberal tradition has empowered us so fully, so completely honored our capacity to choose and to act freely. It is hard to even imagine what our faith looks like without an emphasis on free will and volition. Our worth, our realness as a human is directly related to our capacity to make our own choices, to choose for ourselves. Now, remember what I said about all theological commitments having a consequence. So if you commit to an all-empowered humanity, then you get an impotent or maybe even a non-existent God. As the Reverend Galen Gingrich of All Souls, New York City puts it, it doesn't really matter if God exists or not. Either way, we are God's hands. There is only us. Now, to be clear, the question of free will, despite my sermon title, is greater than the nature and nurture debate. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter if the source of your life circumstances or your personality, the question of free will is a matter of whether or not you have within you the power to respond freely to those givens. One leading psychologist defines it this way. Is the person an autonomous entity who genuinely chooses how to act from among multiple possible options? Or is the person essentially just one link in a causal chain so that the person's actions are merely the inevitable product of lawful causes stemming from prior events and no one could have acted differently than he or she actually did? 2 centuries after Channing, we are still wondering if we are able to fix our eyes upon perfection and make almost everything speed toward it. Or to ask the question as 20th century Unitarian ethicist James Luther Adams put it, is human will a decisive element in human structure? JLA, as he is known, he was so dedicated to the primacy of human freedom and our capacity to choose that he said it was the only claim that you could not disavow and still call yourself a follower of liberal theology. And yet, if we liberal religionists are anything, we are open to new knowledge as it is revealed through science and the evolution of life itself. Which means we have a problem. See, it turns out that scientific studies are now revealing that free will simply does not exist. Don't believe me? Just Google, does free will exist?
Scientific.
And you'll find a slew of articles from Scientific American, Psychology Today, all of those that underscore that our decisions are influenced by many things. Cultural and historical context, environmental factors, our genetic codes, our physiology, our chemistry, biology, just not so much by something we might call our free and conscious will. To offer just a couple specific examples, a Radiolab podcast, which, by the way, if you haven't found Radiolab yet, I commend it to all of you. So this program called Radiolab, again, Google it, Radiolab, a podcast, it offers Malcolm Gladwell in an interview with that journalist, author, brilliant man in general, who describes studies on decision making. One in particular shows how when we meet a stranger and they hand us a warm cup of coffee, for example, versus when we meet one that holds us a cold drink, well, it turns out that we're much more likely to report positive feelings about the one who hands us the warm drink. Because warm drink equals warm person, I guess. Our rational brains at work. So another article in Scientific American quotes scientist Francis Crick, who boldly says, quote, you, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are, in fact, no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Although we appear to have free will, in fact, our choices, get this, our choices have already been predetermined for us, and we cannot change that. OMG. The Puritans were right. I mean, none of these articles on free will find that our decisions are created by an independent conscious mind. In fact, it's becoming less clear if such a thing as the free mind even exists. Not only were we born this way in terms of our personality and physical characteristics, but we were born predisposed to certain choices, born into a particular life, and even born to fulfill what some might call our predetermined destiny. And here is where all this big theological theorizing gets very real. I ask us to turn our attention to that trial that concluded last night in Florida. The trial for George Zimmerman for the killing of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Now, I don't claim to know or understand all the details in the case. I have served on a jury, and if you have, you know. There are particular things that come up, a very particular slice of what you're allowed to decide on. But here's what I think we know. Zimmerman believed Martin was a threat, and he decided to shoot him. And Florida has enacted this law that says that if you believe someone's a threat, you can shoot them in self-defense without being charged with murder. So when I think about this case, I can't help thinking about my racially and economically diverse neighborhood, where visitors inevitably ask us if it's safe. or rather, white visitors want to know if it's safe. Can you walk around, they ask? What about at night? Now, truthfully, my neighborhood is as safe as any in the city. However, it is likely that when you walk, you will run across young African-American men. And if you are a white person in America, it is also likely that you have received cultural and social messages that say young black man equals threat. And so whether or not you as a white person feel safe walking in the neighborhood is a matter of how well you are able to separate the poisonous stereotype of a cultural message from the particular and real-life human being crossing your path. And yet, all these studies show that our capacity to parse out these kinds of decisions, our capacity to make a rational choice, a free choice, is significantly, if not entirely, compromised by factors outside our conscious control. And if we think of it this way, and I suppose to some degree that his jury must have thought of it this way, then we have to ask, at what point is it right to hold George Zimmerman accountable for his actions? At what point, in fact, do we hold any of us accountable for any of our actions? And if it turns out that we are actually not able to choose for ourselves, then what does make us human after all? You know what's extra interesting about all those scientific studies, in addition to the whole free will doesn't exist business? It's that they have also discovered that humanity is better off when we believe that free will exists. Free will, it turns out, this is from the scientists, this is the scientific American. Free will, they say, is a really useful religious myth. They say, they even have this, I read this one article that says maybe it would be better if we just didn't tell anybody about our findings. See, when we assert a deterministic view of life, it turns out that human beings tend to cheat more, lie more, act more selfishly, generally act badly in all kinds of ways, more so than when we assert our capacity for free will. Kind of complicated. Personally, I love this hypocritical proposal from the scientific community, because it aligns with one of my favorite ways to measure religious truth. This is what I ask. Does holding this belief make us more compassionate? Does it make us more kind? Does it help us love each other more? Does it help us love ourselves more? If so, then it's true. Maybe not scientifically true, but religiously true. Fortunately for all of you who like to have your truths line up a little more, however, I have another proposal. One of my kids' favorite books tells the story of a little boy who says he has a volcano in his belly that makes him explode. He tells all his friends and family that they should be extra careful around him because they wouldn't want to set off his volcano. His mom lets this go on for a while, but eventually she sits him down for a little talk. She tells her son that it's good for him to be aware that he has more of a volcano than maybe other kids have. And it's good to let his friends and family know about his volcano. They can help him be more aware of his potential to explode. And they can help him learn things to better anticipate and manage his actions when he does. But ultimately, she tells him, he is still responsible for what he does with that feeling, that volcano in his belly. There are many things about our choices that are not of our own making. There are many things that determine us more than we even realize. But the fact that we are not capable of untethered conscious decision-making does not mean we are not capable of conscious decision-making at all. It just means that human freedom, like I spoke about last week, lives in a paradox of individual autonomy and relationship-based restrictions. If in the 19th century we came to affirm the individual's capacity to choose as the definition of human personhood, what makes someone real, perhaps in the 21st century it is time again to revise our understanding with the corrective of the interdependence of all existence, what we might even think of as a corrective to our understanding of God. Perhaps it is time to acknowledge we are born into relationship with all of creation, all that ever was, is, and will be, born into lives that we did not make ourselves. And then we are empowered to act within this great and given relationship. And it is this acting in relationship rather than as autonomous individual actors that is what makes us real. For it is through relationships of integrity and trust that we can come to understand much of what pushes and pulls on us to choose and to act in one way or another. From this perspective on free will, it seems to me that our call in response to the devastating verdict last night is not to distance ourselves from all the George Zimmermans in our midst, which is to say any of us, all of us, or to call them other somehow, but rather to step forward into fuller relationship, to listen, to learn, to understand, to grow and to act together through relationship. There is nothing easy or straightforward about this kind of moral action. And yet, it is only in these holy partnerships where we can hope to awaken to our lives beyond our choosing, beyond our control. And only in this shared awakening can we help one another act according to consciously identified values and commitments. In the context of these relationships, we are more powerful and more free than we even yet realize. It is a different kind of freedom than we've been taught to value, but it is more satisfying, more meaningful, and more human than any vision of hyper-individualism could promise. To me, this is the critical belief of today's liberal religion. We can create a new world, just not by ourselves. We can act decisively, just not without help. We can consciously act according to our deepest commitments when we do so together. As my favorite quote from my favorite Unitarian Universalist theologian, Rebecca Parker, goes, "None of us alone can save the world. But together, that's another possibility, waiting. May it be so, and amen."